Stairgate method seems to be difficult, but it's not. It's extremely simple. As those who are practicing it, and we can count their numbers today in three figures, as those who are practicing it will bear witness. It appears difficult because it is new. And I did not come into the planet to rehash old methods. I am here to present new ones. And the Clairgate method is new and unique. Therefore, it is an intuitive process. I labored very hard last night to give you an introduction into intuition. And I ended with emphasis on the fact that anything new and original that radiates truth, beauty, and goodness, or any of these, is intuitive. You can almost take that as a definition. Now, the Clairgate method is an attempt, it's a New Age attempt, to reestablish faith as well as understanding in the symbols, the legends, and the myth for man in the West. He has lost contact with these energy reservoirs. The very first lecture that I gave you here, I pointed out that energy reservoirs do exist. They exist in relation to shape. I showed you that spheres or any structure that had perspective was an energy accumulator. I pointed out that sonnets and epic poems are energy accumulators. When we recite them, we release energy to the group that hears them or to ourselves. They are energy accumulators. But man in the West has become so fixed on objective living, on finite things, on matters that can only be understood in terms of his five senses, that he has turned his head away, Janus-like. There's a legend, there's a myth for you. Like Janus, he turns his head away from his subjective and more enduring part, his immortal part, and turns his head towards things that are exciting, that are sharp in definition, that are objective and very, very tangible to his senses, and builds faith in these. Little knowing, or understanding rather, that they are transient, that they are for the moment very real, that they will be taken from him. And this orientation towards things that are fixed, objective, definite, receptive to the senses, has made him lose faith in this part of himself, the subjective part of himself, where lie the great myths and legends, the great concepts of the divine, which Plato spoke about, and Socrates demonstrated, and so on. We have shifted our attention away from them. And so primarily, the Clairgate method is an endeavor to shift man's attention back to that part of him which is eternal, which is energy laden, and which radiates meaning. And the reason why man cannot cope with the stress of the new root race situations is that he lacks access to these subjective reservoirs of energy and meaning. We could sit in a traffic jam every day of our lives for an hour without being irritated if we really knew the meaning and purpose behind that event. if we really understood that this is a new root race, and that its characteristic is going to be stress. It's a characteristic of the way of life of the new root race. And if we understood these things, first of all through the legends of that race, through the myths that lay behind the legends, which are after all only demonstrations by human beings of ancient truths, that's what legends are. So here I am, struggling on a new thing which falls on deaf ears, ears that are deaf because they are oriented towards things that are in the outer world, the current television programs, the current fashions, the ethics, the codes, the mores, the folkways, the social attitudes and culture of the day. We have lost access to those things, and it wouldn't matter. It wouldn't matter an iota if it wasn't the fact that they give us energy. And that's why people are increasingly going down under the weight of stress and suffering emotional and mental breakdown. And new diseases of the mind are emerging every day. And diseases that were rare previously, mental disorders that were rare and could hardly be defined, are frequent today. Things like anorexia nervosa, where a young person deprived emotionally in her childhood suddenly faces up to the exciting new objective world, and part of that new objective world is something that offers a way to continue to deprive herself, as she was emotionally deprived when she was a child, and so she takes up dieting and starves herself quietly to death. Anorexia nervosa, and the hospitals are full of them. Young girls who quietly and surreptitiously throw their food away, hide it under their beds, out of the window, in order to starve themselves. A fixation against getting fat and so on. This sort of new disease is emerging because we haven't the wherewithal to meet the demands on us of our everyday living. The Claregate method helps us to solve this, helps us to re-establish connections with those pools of energy. I have given the elements of this talk, of course, to some of the Claregate students who are here today, and they will forgive me for re-emphasizing what I have said again and again, that the whole structure of our universe, of which we are a part, is based on energy emission. Based on energy emission from a central source. The fact that astronomers are showing that the universe evolved from an original massive explosion or bomb is beside the point. Or bang, I should say, not bomb, I got bombs on the brain. This is our proposition. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and God was the Word. And so even the symbol of Claregate itself is the Word. The original Word, out of which all planes were altered by the Word, and the alterations produced forms on those planes. And so we talk about the plane of divine will or Atma, the plane of divine compassion or Buddhi, and the plane of Manas, and then the mental plane that we have equipment to function in. We have developed it over many, many hundreds of lives. The mental plane, the astral plane, and the physical plane. And all the time the Word of the Divine is radiating outwards, towards us, seated where we are. Not many individuals conform to this pattern. Most of them have got their eyes right here on this wall, which is the outermost fringe of the Word, and they think that is the source of being, the material world, here, down here, and all that it connotes. But it isn't. He's looking this way, and that's the source of energy there. It's a magnificent, if you like, electromagnetic spectrum of spiritual energies constantly flowing out in all directions. And we are born with equipment that lie in here, equipment that lies in these spiritual bands of energy, Atma, Buddhi, and Manas. We call it the higher triad, and here's the lower triad of the personality. And in meditation, we build a bridgehead between the two. We have a subtle thread that links them. We could call it a sutratama. But in meditation and in spiritual disciplines, we build a bridgehead between the two, so that the divine energies filtering down through the planes are able to enter us, enter our aura, if you wish, are able to enter the aura and disperse themselves through the appropriate chakras. And we call this bridgehead the antakarana, the antakarana. And in meditation we progressively construct it. We know that it is absolutely vital, and we progressively construct it, this antakarana. And the books of esoteric anatomy of this college and the other textbooks help us to construct the antakarana, so that the energy of Atma, Buddhi, and Manas can flow down into the aura, so that we can be reflectors of it, so that teaching becomes easy. And that energy can flow out of me. Madame Blavatsky called the human face divine, and it is divine. And out of the right eye flows Buddhi, and out of the left eye flows Manas, and out of the eye between flows Atma. And so you have in your directed gaze the representation of these spiritual energies, whether it's used in teaching or whether it's used in healing. And so the Claregate method is an attempt to take into account this most essential part of man, the hidden, the subjective part of him. Many people are fascinated to such an extent by the outer world, by the making of money, and by this and by that, that they can't turn their heads around. They can't do it. And the more they exercise their senses, the harder it is to turn the head around. Plato tried to describe this in his story of the cave. The men shackled there, facing a bare wall, the bare wall of material things. Behind them a great fire that cast their shadows onto this wall, and they were anchored in such a way that they could see nothing else except their shadows on the wall, and eventually they thought that was life itself. And he said that's the position of man today. He thinks that the shadows on the wall are life itself, this material world. And he said, supposing one man could be able to break his shackle, could tear loose from the chains that chain him to the material world or to the floor of the cave, and he could turn around and he could see that light that was causing the shadows to be reflected on the wall. What an experience to be able to turn around and to see the cause of all things, those shadows on the wall. And what if he could get further still? What if he could take an upward course out of that subterranean cavern where men were shackled? And what if he could take that pathway up to the light above? What an experience for him, not just to see the fire in the cave that was projecting the shadows on the wall, but to come into the upper world and to see the radiant sun that had produced everything. What an experience. So when we talk about energies being available, we may sound like voices crying in the wilderness, but they're very real to us. And the fact that I can do my job, and it's a very hard one, but it's one that I chose as a soul, and therefore it becomes easy, because I know what my soul's purpose is, and therefore everything I do has meaning, and meaning arrives in me. In my aura, it arrives and it discharges its energy into me. And those energies are considerable, and I can draw upon them. And they're available to you, no less. To learn the soul's purpose, and therefore to have access to its energies. That's all we're asking, is that you release your own soul's energies into you. And pray that while they are being released into you for the rest of this life, you will give a little to humanity. That you will be able to balance yourselves in the face of the stressful existence that we all live. And that little that is over, which can become a lot, you will give to humanity. And that's what the Claregate method is based on. Now, we don't know what the divine is. None of us, even if we have confronted the divine way back in our earliest stages of unfoldment, when we did not even possess personalities or vehicles, we've lost memory of it. And so Plato really said that the divine's first apprehension can only be in terms of truth, beauty, and goodness. And whenever we sense truth, we are getting close to an apprehension of the word. For the first thing that it does is to split into three qualities. The original, single energy of God splits into three qualities, a trinity. And Plato called them truth, beauty, and goodness. If you're Hindu, you can call them Shiva, Vishnu, and Brahma. If you are Christian, you can call it Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. It doesn't matter. There is no religion higher than truth. I wish you would go away this weekend with that firmly embedded upon you, in you. And I love the way when things really get hard for many of you, how you revert to your religion. Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. It just comes out, it even comes out of me. Not that there's anything wrong with that mantra. The new religions are going to be religions indeed, but they're going to be religions that are going to express natural energies. Light, heat, magnetism, color. That's what the new religions are going to do. And our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, is going to be an expression of energy rather than a faith symbol. And so the word pours out and we apprehend it vaguely right down here, down through the plains. We apprehend it vaguely as truth and beauty and goodness. Beautiful, radiant energy. Sometimes when we go in a gallery, we sense beauty. It's a wonderful experience. Or we have it in a dream that transforms us all day. We've had the dream the night before and it hovers over us. Some of us in our ashram in England don't even want to share the dream with anybody else anymore because the magic is broken when you share it. When you try and describe the dream, you break the magic of it. And the dream will hover over you all day long, discharging its energies into you. And as you go through the day and you pick up something in the kitchen, you're about to wash up, some part of the dream comes through to you. Yes. And immediately there's a discharge of energy into you. And I've got energy flowing into me now, great rushes of it coming down my spine when I just released just a simple little truth like that. And it was Jung that showed in a scientific way that this is true. In a scientific way. That's the importance of Jung. He was not mouthing new things in the sense that I mentioned them here tonight. What he was doing was taking old truths and putting them into scientific language that could be tested by scientists, psychiatrists of his day. And he said just that. That the dreams that we have, and they don't have to be dreams, lying in your bed with your head on your pillow and snoring. They can be daydreams. They can be vrittis. They can be the elements of meditation. And the more that you are aware of them, and we all have them, no one is exempt. We all have them. Sometimes we can't remember them. Sometimes it's the soul's purpose for the individual not to dream, or not to remember his dreams, I should say. Because he has been too dreamy in the past. But But those magnificent reservoirs of energy, they settle on us and feed us all day long. The moment that we have a meaning to what we're doing, energy comes into you. I live by it. I live by it. And so truth, beauty, and goodness, we begin in many ways. The scientist struggling with his microscope, truth. The artist, beauty. And the philosopher and the world server, goodness. And he apprehends them. We use other devices. We use the psychology of the seven rays because we understand that the Trinity breaks into seven. First the one, then the three, then the seven. And so we have a psychology of the seven rays which helps us to apprehend these energies more. And we know that each of our bodies is affected by a particular ray. Hence the ray psychology, the attempt to understand these energies in terms of a septenary. We know from ancient teachings that the word is a septenate. It's a seven-qualitied thing. Just like we have 23 pairs of chromosomes, the solar system, the solar logos is built in sevens, and every part of him, including you, is built in sevens. And so we use a ray psychology based on this ancient knowledge. We call it the psychology of the seven rays. And that gives us further understanding of these huge energies that are being emitted. And then we break it down even further and we say, yes, the seven rays are expressed through 12 signs of the zodiac. And so the seven becomes 12. We talk about signs of the zodiac which embody in their symbols the glyphs, the outer indication of the qualities of energies that are being released. And so we use now symbols and glyphs, or rather glyphs, to understand the energy packages that are coming to us. We are seated in an energy world, and these energy packages are flowing into us. And according to the quality of our bodies, we receive certain energy packages. My third ray physical body receives energy packages on the third ray of active intelligence. And for me, Saturnian energy is something I can call on any time I wish. I can teach in the middle of the night. I can teach while I'm in the bath. I can teach when I'm on the lavatory, if that impacts your consciousness more to understand it. For I have access to the Lord of Saturn, who is one of the seven spirits before the throne. It doesn't matter what the terminology is. If you've had any access to culture or religion, there is sympathy here in my expression for those religions and cultures that you grew up with. And the point that I'm making now is that in the Claregate method, we accept a set of glyphs. We accept a set of cuneiform of signs or symbols which tell us what these energies mean. And they're interplaying with each other all the time. They're crossing each other. And they're cycling in and cycling out. That's the beauty of this many splendid thing which we call the divine. And we are receiving stations for it. And so we have the 12 signs of the zodiac. Aries, Taurus, Gemini, Cancer, and so on, right the way round. And these signs or glyphs merely indicate to us a new permutation of these divine energies. A new permutation. And then we take the rulers of the signs, which gives us yet another way of expressing the many permutations. We say that Taurus is ruled by Vulcan, and Aries is ruled by Mercury, and Gemini is ruled by Venus, and so on. And another band of glyphs is available. And so in the end we have a blueprint. We have a grid, as it were, that fits onto this energy source of ours. It's a grid, it's like a piece of acetate that you put over it. It's a circle, remember the mandala from last night. It's a circle divided into 12 segments, and it contains three bands of rotating circles, which means they can rotate on each other, the middle one is fixed and the outer two are rotating, and we pick up this acetate and we put it over the divine. And the source of this grid comes down to us from countless centuries of observation of man's psychology and the heavens above. Remembering that man reflects the heavens above. The universe is reflected into a man. Man is a microcosm of the macrocosm. As above, so below. And so these ancient laws we use. And we know that we have now a grid that is becoming clearer and clearer and clearer and more apparent to us. A grid that can be used to gauge the kind of energies that we, existentially, each one of us differently, are able to apprehend. You're different from me, and you have susceptibility to combinations of those energies which are unusual. When the energies are grouped together, we call them a complex. The complex of Jung. So we talk about the apprenticeship complex, in which we have something like Venus in Gemini in the 10th. An apprenticeship complex. Well, we all know what an apprenticeship complex is. It's a bundle of energy that hovers over a little boy. Your little boy. And this energy discharges itself into the boy and helps him to build his astral body. And helps him to build his mental body. And makes it a fine one. And the apprenticeship complex consists of energies which makes the boy want to be like his daddy. And when he grows up, he wants to be a milkman like his daddy, or an engine driver like his daddy. And even though you yourself know that he won't be an engine driver, that doesn't matter. The little boy acts out his fantasy. He is fed with the energy of the apprenticeship complex, which is available to all children, boys or girls. They want to be like their parent. And it's a good complex. And it discharges its energy into the little boy. And he grows. The energy feeds him. And the astral body, the emotional nature grows. And he grows up a fine lad. By the time he's 14 or 15, the energy complex is exhausted. Its energies have all been discharged into him. He no longer wants to do what daddy does. In fact, now he doesn't want to do what daddy does. In fact, it's the last thing in the world that he wants to do. Especially if daddy was in Vietnam. So you get the opposite of it. And one of the biggest complexes of all is the ego. The ego complex. And nobody can put a personality together without an ego complex. And it's there. The ego complex is also there, feeding its energy in to the developing sets of vehicles, this ego complex. And it's fine. The person grows up and functions as a personality. However, events in the outer world may be so traumatic as to destroy access to his ego complex. He loses his self-respect. He loses confidence. Things happen in his life that makes him falter. And he loses access to the ego complex. He hasn't got an I am in him anymore. Ego complex, I am. I am as an ego. I am that. Which means I've turned my head towards that. And I am that I am, eventually. Never mind it. I'm merely pointing out to you that it doesn't matter whether you are Christians oriented to the Old Testament or to the New Testament or whatever religion you're part of. It's all here. And so the Clare Gates method is a method whereby you establish a language of communication down through this channel. A language of communication with a higher self. The higher self that contains truth, beauty, and goodness in great measure. It is the eternal part of ourselves. All we're trying to do is to communicate with it. If you can't communicate with a higher self, you are choked of energies. You can't get meaning. You can't get energies. And that is all the esoteric sciences have ever claimed to want to do, is to establish a contact with the higher self, that which has been there when that died. I died as this, but I remained there. I died as that, and I remained there. And each life takes something new and more and rewarding and refreshing into the soul that it needs. We teach that the soul is here on earth to develop, not spirit. It has spirit. It's here on earth to develop spiritual staying power. And that is why we say that when people argue and say, if we are perfect as souls, what the hell are we doing on earth? The soul is perfect in terms of truth, beauty, and goodness, but its spiritual quality cannot be sustained. It needs staying power for an immense cosmic thing that happens. Eventually, when the soul has staying power, has gained it through having part of itself put into 700 bodies on this planet alone, and has gained the staying power from extracting each body from its attachments to the material world, that's how it gets its staying power. Life after life, it has to detach its bodies from the objective world, and that's a tremendously developing thing. When it's got its staying power, an immense thing occurs. It moves back to its origin and becomes one with an immense chakra of which it was part. And then that chakra, an immense cosmic wheel, we call it the one about whom naught may be said, begins to donate its energies to an alter ego, as I described it yesterday. An immense cosmic thing. And so, perfected, the monad, having been through the planes of matter, moves to a higher chakra. We call this initiation, the fifth initiation, which takes us out of this solar system into the great system of Sirius, which is the Ajna center of a great being. Our solar system is the heart chakra of that great being. So many of the mysteries of initiation become clear, that we are caught up in a cosmic process. The great temples of Egypt at Karnak, the ones at Stonehenge that you see when you come to England, the sun and moon temples, are great structures helping us to understand we're part of a cosmos, that we're not caught up on a tiny little planet lost in space called Earth, that we're part of a greater plan, a greater cosmos. We're all tiny little cogs in an immense plan. And these old temples help man to understand that. And so the Claregate method is one in which we take the horoscope, the time of birth and the place of birth indicates this grid. This grid, as it applies to you, the time and space of you, indicates your grid. Not my grid, your grid. And then you take your grid and place it over this. And so we can say, all right, this region here, this segment here of the divine, this is the home of the soul. This part of the grid tells us the soul's purpose. This part of the grid here indicates access to energies in the outer world. This part here. And that energy which we call money or concretized prana, this segment. This is the segment of education. It tells us about, and so we can label all with glyphs, all the energies that are flowing into consciousness, which is nothing more than taking a 12-spoked wheel and filling in the different glyphs that I've indicated, and that is your mandala. That is your reflection of the divine. Your reflection of the divine. And it can tell you things. And when we say tell you things, we mean it conveys meaning to you. And that meaning also has with it these vast energies. So that is what the Claregate method does. Appear in your hypnagogia, that those symbols and images are going to be from your everyday life. They're not going to be angels and all the paraphernalia of the Piscean age. They were. Used to be. Because you used to spend so much time in church. And most of the symbols that were either from the field where man served as a serf and had very few symbols at all, or they all came out of the Catholic Church, out of the Mass, the rich imagery. And so the idols went up all over the place. And in those days, man was very secure. He had his church, and he believed in the images there, and his unconscious was full of devices which could release energy into him. But that's lost. In England today, and I'm not even going to suggest Europe, in England today, attendance at church has dropped to 1.5%. There's no arguing about it. And the church gets the child at birth, raises him in the church. He has religious instruction at school. After school, he's married in the church. And all these things are done, but it still can't hold the population. Only 1.5%. And they get all day Sundays, and they get television space and God knows what. Still can't hold the population. Because the symbols used by religion today are no longer expressive. They are worn out. They're like cliches. Proverbs are laden with energy and meaning, as I have shown in my book, Astrology 6. Laden with energy and meaning. But where one of these, a saying, has been used excessively, it becomes a cliche. The energy has been absorbed and used and worn out. So the cliche is a thing we don't like to use in good language anymore. So, you see, I can go into all sorts of fields and show you how this knowledge is so rich and helpful to you. It can help you with your language and so on. And so the upshot of this all this is that you can't use effectively ordinary language. Don't expect to get back a categoric answer to a question that you put to the soul. You won't get it. But you will get it in image. And so we, in the Claregate method, we take questions or complexes or what we prefer to call aspects. And an aspect is a description in glyphs of an energy packet. An aspect is a description in glyphs of an energy packet. So we put an aspect down here. We put an aspect down in the spiritual diary. Choose a new page. The war's over. There's no paper shortage. So choose a new page of the diary and you put an aspect down. Let's say Mars related to Jupiter in your horoscope. Picture of the horoscope there. And there is... You want to know, please, tell me. What does this mean in my life? It's in here. It's in here. It's part of me. Mars is related to Jupiter, which means that there's a package of energy there. Mars and Jupiter, it's relevant to me. Tell me what it means. And tell me what you want me to do with it, please. I have this potential, this energy in my life. Tell me what to do with it, please. And so you proposition. Kitty, get me sent for one of those arrows. And you put the proposition down in the diary, and you arrow it. This is what I am focused on, my soul. Please help me. Tell me what it means. Well, thanks to our efforts, you don't have to beg and whine for it. You can just put it in the diary. And then, all you need do... Already they have crept onto the counters. I didn't ask them to make them, but they've done them. And they're exactly what they copied from my original diaries. Arrows. And so you take an arrow... And if you are not going to fiddle around with it, you can leave it there. Arrowing it in the diary, or you can take a piece of tape and fix it on so that if the wind blows through your bedroom window, it's not going to disturb it. So you have arrowed. You have taken all your aspiration to reach him, and you have arrowed what it is you would like him to consider. Now he understands you. You have taken glyphs which are countless centuries old. He understands a universal language. You have put it into a glyph form that he comprehends. And immediately you put your head on the pillow at night, or the moment you go into meditation, or the moment that you go into reverie or daydreaming or hypnagogia or hypnopompia, these two expressions, hypnagogia, the period of going off to sleep. All esotericists learn to extend it. If you are a person who puts your head on the pillow one moment and is dead asleep, snoring your head off the next moment, you're a fool. You have secured exhaustion of the physical body, exhaustion of the senses, that's the important thing. You're able to say to the senses, now I've got you, shut up. You are in a state of hypnagogia. You extend it. From a 5-minute period, you extend it to half an hour. It's a critical period in consciousness. And it's a period in which he can pour answers into you. And he will give them to you in visual images. Hundreds of them. Hundreds of them. If you had the wherewithal to apprehend them. Right through the night. Nothing else. Nothing else. So long as you check the senses. And that's the rub. There's the rub. This method would have been discovered years ago. But very, very few men can check the senses. The moment that you lay your heads on your meditation couch or on your pillows, the thoughts begin to fly through the brain, elaborate things, you're listening to matters going on in the kitchen, and you are creating a constant stream. You are creating a constant stream of thoughts. There they are, think about this, then that, then this, then that, then this, then that, then this, then that. And all day long you are surrounded in a constant stream of thoughts, and you damn well know this is true. And even when you sit down and you say, stop it! The moment that you say stop, the mind says, here, watch this. What's this damn rebellion going on here? You're telling me to stop enjoying myself. Here I'm feeding off the senses. I'm having the time of my life, I'm producing thought after thought, and you, who was in here before, inside here before as an ego, you're suddenly getting up here and you're telling me to stop it. That's what I'm asking you to do. You are surrounded in a constant stream of thought, so that Madame Blavatsky had to say in the ancient wisdom, in the voice of the silence, and in all our great classical teaching, she had to say, the mind is the slayer of the real. And the mind is the lord of the senses. And as the senses are active, the mind is active. And it elaborates thought after thought after thought. And so long as it is elaborating thoughts, it's content. So that it is a deva, as we know, and it has become an entity in your lives. The mental body is a deva. It is a tyrant. It demands every moment of your attention until you tread the path. Until you say to yourself, no, damn it, I'm just not going to allow it to go on. And you step out of yourself. And you learn to do this increasingly. You just watch that mind as it goes on elaborating the same repetitive old junk hour after hour. The strange thing is that the moment that you do that, the moment you step out of yourself, and get up there, as you are taught in psychosynthesis, and look down at this mental body. The mental body doesn't like that. It's just as if you're walking along the street and you think that you know somebody who's walking towards you. And you stare at them as they come towards you. You're looking at me. And they falter in their steps. The mind is just like that when you begin to observe it. The rush of thinking, the rush of thoughts, one after the other, begins to slow down. And that is what we try to do in meditation, is to slow down the stream of thoughts. And what we're trying to do is to create a gap. There's the gap. As Swami Rama says, and he should know, as Swami Rama says, meditation begins in the space between thoughts. Meditation begins in the space between thoughts. If you think meditation is thinking kind thoughts about your neighbor when you're normally thinking horrible thoughts, then you're wrong. Not that there's anything wrong with thinking kind thoughts. Energy follows thought. But you must understand that meditation is not thinking. Meditation begins in the space between thoughts. And if you can create that gap, then the elements of the Om, the elements of the Word of God, the nature of the soul will rush in, trying to reach you, rush into you, if you can create that space. And in these moments of psychopompia, when we are coming out of a deep sleep in the morning and becoming lighter and lighter in consciousness and are dimly aware of the world outside, but the senses are not yet functioning, that's a pregnant period. And we try and extend the period of waking in the morning as we did going to sleep at night. It's the first thing that you do. And with it you slow down the breath, slow down the breathing. And then you thin this down, you thin it down like that. And the soul can easily break through that, can easily break through that. And begins to feed you with answers, answers to the proposition that you have put to it. And then later as you become expert and you begin to recognize when this process has stopped properly, you can do the propositioning. You can put your monastic material, your abstracted thought, which is unrelated to mundane matters of living, you can proposition the soul in the space between thoughts. And that is a method whereby you constantly raise your consciousness progressively. Here's the thoughts, you slow them down, and in the space between the thoughts there, you proposition the soul. You try and reach the soul. And you do that by taking the simplest glyphs from your chart, that glyph there, Mars and Jupiter. You take the simplest glyphs, you translate them into the simplest language. My powerful friend, powerful Mars, Jupiter friend, my powerful friend. You can visualize a powerful friend. You can't do that. Just choose the most powerful friend you've got. I'll do. Just put him there. Just put him there. Then you take the same, and you could do that for a whole night. You're trying to do it. Then the next night, take a permutation of that, which is different, but more subtle, more spiritual. And then a more spiritual one, and a more spiritual one. You're still doing Mars and Jupiter, and you're getting beyond the realms of interference of the mind, and you're reaching up there. And then he starts, come on, come on, you're doing well, come up the ladder. And ladders have been described again and again right down through esoteric cultures. The use of Jacob's ladder, the use of this ladder, that ladder. And so you create a ladder of permutations that reaches up to the soul, and you tread them in consciousness. And each time you go back, you discard the lower permutation, and you take a higher one, and a higher one, and a higher one. Now, I have exceeded my time, but I feel, who is prepared to wait 5 minutes, 10 minutes at the most? All those who feel they can't, I'd be happy if you left right now. I'm sure you have appointments. But I must just finish this part of the talk off with a demonstration of permutation. Please don't think that this is just Douglas Baker talking. There are 30 people in this audience who in less than a year have learnt to do this themselves, are rewarded by feedback from the soul. And they can identify themselves to you any time, and they will help you do it. You can take, even if you've never done any astrology before, but I do recommend that you do the Donath's course in this respect. If you've never done any astrology before, you can start to keep a spiritual diary. You can extract aspects of the simplest order from it, and any of the Claregate group will tell you how to do it. And when you start to get feedback, when you start to get meaning back from the higher self, and you can't understand the feedback, go to them. They'll help you. And if they can't help you, wait for me, and one day I'll help you with them. But certainly the answers are there. And so we're going to take this very simple thing, and we're going to say Jupiter trine to Mars. All of you have got Jupiter and Mars in your horoscope. I'm not doing my horoscope. I'm taking a simple example, Jupiter and Mars, and we're assuming that in this case they're trine. A friendly check, C-H-E-C-K. A friendly check. By that we mean, of course, that you check somebody, you stop somebody. Don't do that. Don't do that, dear. That's not the way to do it. A friendly check. And so put Jupiter above friendly, and check is Mars. Mars blocks, halts, stops things in their tracks. That's Mars. And so this is a simple permutation. But it could also mean a friendly check from somebody giving you some money. Other people's money. Mars, other people's money. And so you can repeat it if you like. Or you could say, if it's easier for your meditation, a big check. A big check, which is Jupiter. Jupiter is big and broad. Alf is my symbol for Jupiter. Where's Alf Hansen? Alf Hansen is my symbol for Jupiter. They're big and they're broad, but they're not slow. They're damn nimble on their feet. Jupiter, yes. So that's not difficult. And you could put those in the space between thoughts with increasing reward. Now I'm going to make it a little more complex, and I'm going to say Jupiter conjunct Mars. Put it over here, would you? Jupiter conjunct Mars and Gemini in the first. And all I'm doing is to take an aspect which has one thing here, one there, and one there, and bind them together. Now, you may not have this in your chart. It's a little more complex. And so we will say, keeps a friendly check on younger brothers on the path. Keeps a friendly check on younger brothers on the path. Now, the Claregate crowd, any one of them, would tell you how to allocate the symbols to that. Gordon can do it on his own, but I'm going to do it to save time. Keeps one, first house. Keeps first house, a friendly Jupiter. Check Mars on your younger Venus, and Gemini rules young manifestations of youngness, or younger brothers. So that's Gemini twice. Becky, why can I use Gemini twice? Because it's in the first house. And the first house enables you to repeat meaning again and again and again and again. And so I'm going to use Gemini three times here. Keeps a friendly check on younger brothers on the path. There you are. There's another permutation. But note that the permutation has slipped out of the mundane world. It's no longer in the mundane world of the objective. Now you're suggesting, or the soul is suggesting to you, because you have this in your horoscope, and it is in the first house, and it always tells the soul's purpose. Therefore, one of the soul's purposes here expressed is, keep a friendly check on your younger brothers on the path. What do we mean by a younger brother, anybody? Those who are less evolved than us. Thank you, Rose. It's one wisdom. I never knew Rose until 6 months ago, but she knew that. A younger brother, and that's what it's saying, and that's what esoteric astrology means. You take the esoteric meaning, and it is part of this person's soul's purpose to look after their younger brothers on the path. So there is a spiritual meaning emerging. Of course, I could have put 30 in there. 30 other permutations. I'm in a hurry. Now I'm going to ask you to rub the first one out and still take the same aspect. We can rub it all out. Leave the aspect, right. Now I'm going to take the same aspect, and I'm going to ask Gordon to put down psychological damage sustained by a brother. Psychological damage sustained by a brother. Jupiter rules the house of psychology. The psychologist, the psychiatrist, as long as he's not medical. And so, psychological, Jupiter, damage Mars, especially where there is damage, Mars, Gemini, where there is cleavage, things torn apart. So we'll have damage as being Mars and Gemini. Mars and Gemini together, Mars and Gemini, yes, good. sustained, first house. First house is anything that's sustained, like the soul, lives forever. First house. Left, right, left, right, left, right, left, right, left, 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 right, left. And that's why the first house is not only the soul's purpose because it's immortal, but it rules generals. It rules generalship and leadership and fascism. Left, right, left, right, left. Do as your damn well told. Left, right, left, right, left. Did you hear what I said then? Do as your damn well told. That's the sort of attitude you should understand of the soul, that the soul tells you what to do. Otherwise, there's no purpose for your existence on the earth if you are not doing what the soul tells you to do. And so this is something which you can gain from the same aspect if it was in your horoscope, and it indicates that you have a brother who is susceptible to psychological damage and possibly could take precautions for it. Same one again underneath it, Gordon. A series of extremely unchivalrous acts or attitudes. A series of extremely unchivalrous acts or attitudes. Yes, it's hard work. My God, it's hard work. So we'll translate the same thing from your horoscope. A series, Jupiter, of extremely, first house. Series, Jupiter, extremely, first house. Unchivalrous, Mars. I'm going to make that square to Jupiter now, please. I'm sorry, Jupiter square to Mars, assuming that's in the horoscope. Mm-hmm. Unchivalrous, Mars, or square Mars in Gemini. Chivalry, Mars trine to Venus. The chivalrous knight in shining armor. Mars trine to Venus. Mars square to Venus or Gemini, unchivalrous. Extremely unchivalrous acts, Gemini, or attitudes, first house. Therefore, your advice, your spiritual advice to the person who's consulting you, who's put her chart in front of you, beware of unchivalrous acts. They are a thing that you have come into this life, because it's in the first house, you have come into this life to learn not to have unchivalrous attitudes. Part of the soul's purpose, mark you. All right? Now let us go right out of the realms of the semi-spiritual and go right up here. The moment that you go into legend, the moment you go into myth, the moment you go into spiritual concept, you're up here. And of course it's a little harder to posit this to the soul. And so we're going to take now, I'm leaving a gap out, we're going to take now a legend. And first of all, I can just do this. I'm going to suggest this to help you with the legend. I'm going to say Mars related to Jupiter, stopcock. Stopcock. Now, a stopcock in England is a tiny little thing that looks something like that, and you put it into a glass vessel and it stops water flowing out of it. Is that correct? You understand? Right. I should say 2 minutes. Stopcock. Stopcock, something that stops water. Jupiter's the ruler of Aquarius and glass vessels. Glass vessels containing water, Aquarius. Jupiter the ruler of Aquarius. Mars, stop. Stopcock. Also implying the sexual thing. Stopcock. Perfect. Absolutely perfect. It means just that. Now, if we were to take that into legend, a legend which tells a story of a person who stops water from flowing out of something that could hurt mankind. The story in Dutch legend of the little boy walking along the dike who sees water pouring through a hole in the dike, and he pushes his hand into the dike and holds the water back and stops it so that the dike is not breached, and he saves his village, his community, from drowning. Stops the dike from being breached. What has that done to you if you know the legend of the little Dutch boy that sacrificed himself as a stopcock? It takes you into the realm of the mystical, of legend, of heroism, of service to mankind, of forgetfulness of your own... You're in the world of the soul now. You're in the fifth kingdom. And you have presented it here. This is Stopcock. You're right up here, the story of it. And all the time, the soul is reaching you. You're there with him. And he's pouring energy and meaning into you. And for the one legend that I have quoted, he can give you 10 or 20 or 30 or 40, as many as you can write down. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.